Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How safe are we from terrorism on American soil? Last month, a grand jury indicted a North Texas man for allegedly attempting to blow up a skyscraper in downtown Dallas. Hossan Sam Smadi apparently believed the dummy weapon sold to him by undercover FBI agents was in fact the real thing. So how were federal agents able to figure out his alleged intentions before he could obtain a real weapon? And what resources and training does such a successful interception require? Oliver Buck Revell is president of the Revell Group International and former associate deputy director of the FBI. He is scheduled to speak to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth this evening at 6:30 about the law enforcement view of terrorism. Buck, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
How does the FBI identify suspects who might be preparing to commit terrorist acts?
Well, there's a number of different ways. Obviously, one way is sources, people who come forward that have heard or overheard conversations, seen actions that raise suspicions and come to the Bureau or to the police and say, I'm concerned about this person and what they're saying and what they're doing. In this particular case, it was by monitoring the Internet. And by that, I mean that anything that is put out on the Internet is public information. It's like picking up the newspaper from the corner. Now, when you get into specific emails, then you have to have a court order to intercept and to actually read the emails. But those things that are on websites and on open blogs are subject to scrutiny. And since 9/11, the FBI has been given a lot more resources and authority to monitor the websites and the open blogs to determine people that are going beyond rhetoric, beyond First Amendment protected speech, but into specific calls for direct action and even plotting and planning acts of terrorism.
So are you using pieces of technology that search for specific phrases associated with other phrases? Is that how it goes? Does it happen first through some kind of machine and then a human being checks it?
I really can't go into that area because it is classified. But obviously, there are over 3,000 known jihadi websites that are hosted on ISPs in the United States, over 6,000 globally. There has to be technology involved in detecting those areas that are of concern. You know, frankly, the FBI nor the police or anyone else is interested in who you're going to play bridge with or are you going to get together for drinks after work. So there are certain key indicators that are looked for. And many of them now are in code and using certain terms to represent certain other meanings. And you have to have had source information to know what that is to be able to connect it to areas that at least raise concerns.
What criteria do agents use to decide whether a source or an informant can be trusted?
Well, you never trust a source or informant without, one, essentially doing a background on them and determining many of them will have very bad backgrounds.
They know what they know.
That's right. So you need to know about them, make sure they've been truthful with you about their background, about their activities. Check on other individuals that have known and worked with them, and then you verify their work product. You verify what they tell you by independent means. And then once you reach a level of confidence, you still verify. So it's a point of continuing scrutiny of what you're being told, and never accepting that what you're told by an informant or if it's an overseas asset as being absolutely factual and that you act upon it. You always attempt to verify and take it as far as you can to ascertain its validity.
Of course, there are different kinds of terrorism. There is obviously Islamist extremism. There are people who want to bomb abortion clinics. There's eco-terrorism. Are they all handled in very specific, different ways?
Well, the domestic groups, those, for instance, that assassinate doctors or blow up clinics that perform abortions, the so-called eco-terrorists, the animal rights activists, and so forth, they're handled much in the same way as a general criminal case. And if you get a wiretap, you go to a local federal judge. You do not have to have the specific authorities to investigate the domestic groups that you do to investigate the international groups. The international guidelines are classified. The domestic guidelines are not. So now the methodology they use, in other words, bombings and shootings and assassinations, make them terrorist acts, but they're treated differently because the law treats them differently. The federal law created the Foreign Surveillance Intelligence Court. The Attorney General created its separate intelligence guidelines. And generally, you're dealing with both the diplomatic and the intelligence community overseas and investigating those cases.
Whether this is fair and accurate or not, I think lay people who are asked to picture a terrorist get a very specific picture in their minds. And then occasionally you have serious offenders who don't match that at all. I'm thinking about Terry Nichols and Timothy McVeigh. How are FBI employees encouraged to understand what the profiles might be and yet never limit their vision in investigating a case or pursuing someone who might be ready to cause harm? Never allow that to sort of limit them, keep them from seeing someone else who doesn't look like the standard.
I think profiles are greatly overrated. The Unabomber, I think I had seven or eight different profiles on the Unabomber. Only one of them was accurate. The profile is simply a means to try and organize information and look in particular categories. So what you get from television on the profilers running around the country solving cases is simply totally inaccurate. It is useful in looking at certain sort of organizational activities. But the lone wolf is an entirely different circumstance. And you can have, for instance, the individual that went into the museum in Washington, into the Holocaust Museum. Well, he was a neo-Nazi, but you could not tell that from looking at him. Now, if they had reason to do a background on him and know what he had said and what he had done and so forth, he would have fit a profile that would indicate a person of possible danger, particularly to something like the Holocaust Museum or to some institution, some Jewish institution and so forth, because he was essentially a neo-Nazi in his ideology. But you now have females who are shaheeds, suicide bombers. You have children, of course, who are indoctrinated and not in the United States so far, thank goodness, but in the Middle East, that walk up to a group and explode themselves. So you really can't look at an individual and say, well, this person is possibly a terrorist. It just doesn't work that way. And it would be helpful if it did, but it's much more complex than that.
The FBI's Joint Terrorism Task Force has existed since 1980, but correct. I imagine it's evolved significantly since 9/11.
I actually approved the first Joint Terrorism Task Force. I was the assistant director in charge of criminal investigations in Washington, and the New York office came down, a deputy assistant director there named Ken Walton, and proposed that we take what was in the bank robbery task force and convert part of it into a joint terrorism task force, because elements of the Weather Underground were robbing banks and actually had killed a bank, our bank guards and police officers. And they had operated up and down the East Coast all the way from Norfolk up past New York. We approved that first task force, and we deputized the officers, New York City Police, Transit Authority, Port Authority, and State Police to be federal agents working with us hand in hand. They all received security clearances and were deputized, and that became the first. I think at the time of 9/11, when I left the Bureau in 91, there were 26. I think at the time of 9/11, there was something like 32. Now there's 107 joint terrorism task forces, including, of course, here in Dallas and one in Fort Worth.
Are there ever issues with jurisdiction and even simply, if not arguing over jurisdiction, just questions about who's supposed to be in charge of what when you have local law enforcement agencies now that also have anti-terrorism task forces?
Well, local law enforcement agencies generally don't have terrorism task forces.
I'm thinking about places like New York.
Well, New York doesn't have the New York Task Force is part of the JTTF.
Okay.
Now, they have an intelligence division. Mm-hmm. And there was a recent case out of Colorado and New York where the intelligence division went off on its own. And there was a big fight, but it was between the JTTF New York contingent and the New York intelligence division, not the FBI. By and large, most chiefs of police have come to understand that they need the broad view of the intelligence world. They themselves are eligible to receive clearances and be briefed into all of the operations of the JTTFs. David Kunkel here in Dallas was briefed in, and his officers directly participated in the Somadi case. It has been a very good vehicle for solving a problem that we have 18,000 police agencies in the United States. We have over 200 federal agencies with some sort of law enforcement authority. So even though the FBI is given the jurisdiction, there are other crimes that at times will be involved in the activities of the groups or organizations that are using terrorist tactics. And so we want to be sure that, for instance, we have Secret Service and ATF, Customs, well, it's actually the Customs and Border Security now that are part of the task forces, as, of course, we always need the immigration because many of the individuals in the international arena are already in violation of U.S. law through their immigration status, as Somadi was.
In addition, Buck, to attempting to prevent terrorist acts before they take place, people who work for the FBI are also working so that cases will be able to be made against these people. What kinds of decisions have to be made in terms of when to move in and how much evidence to collect? Because you're sort of walking that fine line between if you mm-hmm. move too fast, maybe you can't prosecute somebody who absolutely did mean harm.
Well, the Somadi case is another good example. It was monitored through physical surveillance, through electronic surveillance. Every move he made was under surveillance. Meaning the Bureau, it's hard not to say we after 30 years, but they knew everything he was doing and knew that he did not have access except through the undercover agent to explosive material. So in that case, it actually went up to the point of him punching in the numbers on the cell phone to blow it up and waiting to hear the explosion. Now, if you didn't have that type of control, you can't let it go that far. You never allow a terrorist act to occur. That doesn't mean that, they won't, because you don't know what you don't know. And in an open society, in a society that protects information through the First Amendment and the rights of individuals and groups and organizations, there will be times and circumstances when a terrorist act will be completed. And although I think you can debate whether or not recent events at Fort Hood was a terrorist act, it certainly carried a terrorism connotation with it. And were there indications that Major Hassan should have been examined very carefully before? Certainly. Why it didn't happen, we'll have to wait and see. But a terrorist circumstance can happen, let's just say, in a clinic where one of the workers decides that abortions are abhorrent and decides to take an action, and you won't know.
Buck Revell is my guest. He's president of Revell Group International and former associate deputy director of the FBI. We're talking today about the law enforcement view of terrorism. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can make your passion your career. Evening classes are now available in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Buck Revell, who is president of Revell Group International and former associate deputy director of the FBI. He will speak tonight to the World Affairs Council on the subject of law, the law enforcement view of terrorism. You can find information about that event at dfwworld.org or on the Think page of KERA.org. If you want to join our conversation, give us a call now at 1-800-933-5372. Let's go first to Bonnie in Rockwall. Hello, Bonnie.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Listen, I just want to say I was thrilled with the news report about Smadi. It just played out like a textbook, I'm sure, on many more levels than I could even understand. And I just want to applaud all those that were involved. I feel safer, and you know, it's good to get some good news. Unfortunately, his life is probably not going to be the same as an individual, but anyway, Dallas is safer. One of the things I'm curious, though, is how can some of these same techniques or whatever you want to call them be carried over into something like the Fort Hood incident? I understand that that's the Army. It's a different entity. There's different jurisdictions and so forth. But I would really, really like to understand how that was able to happen. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
Well, of course, there were certain emails that were intercepted by order of the Federal Surveillance Court, the FISA court. They were studied and reviewed within the Bureau and then shared with the Army. The determination was at that time that they really fell within the area of his research on post-traumatic shock syndrome for Muslim soldiers, U.S. Muslim soldiers serving in the Middle East where they might be brought into combat against other Muslims. So when that information was turned over to the Army, the Bureau at that point steps out because he is on the active military and is subject to the Uniform Code of Military Justice. There were several actions that have come to light in the media that have occurred after that, including presentations at seminars, statements to fellow soldiers, statements in talking about justification for a Muslim using jihad or committing becoming a shaheed, committing suicide bombing. That, in my mind, if true, should result in a very close scrutiny of the process. I was concerned with General Casey's statement, the Chief of Staff of the Army, that, well, they had to be concerned about their diversity. And that's true. I, for one, advocated recruiting more Middle Eastern and Muslim agents and analysts in the FBI before I retired. But diversity can never be an excuse for lack of scrutiny or paying attention to indications that an individual has become radicalized. And there are many, many capabilities out there now to become radicalized. Thousands of jihadist websites. Over 10% of the mosques in the United States are considered to be under the Wahhabi element of Islam, the most conservative and the most extreme element of Sunni Islam. Doesn't mean that all people who follow the Wahhabi faith, of the Wahhabi sect, are going to be terrorists. But it is an area that if you have information that they are participating with that element, it is one more factor to consider. So, yes, it is very difficult to determine, particularly a lone wolf or a very small cell. It's not like they're going back and forth to Al-Qaeda Central and the tribal areas of Pakistan. You also have to be concerned about the protection of the First Amendment rights of all individuals and achieve the correct balance. So we don't want a society where every piece of email is reviewed and determined whether it's appropriate or not, but we do want to follow up when there are signs, indications, or perhaps clues or evidence of an individual turning to the radical side and committing themselves to, in this case, jihad or with other terrorist groups to bomb an abortion clinic or to blow up transmission towers.
What, Buck, are the impediments to recruiting an adequate number of FBI agents who have the language skills and the cultural backgrounds necessary for the world we live in right now?
Well, there are so many languages and cultures involved. I mean, most people think, well, if, you know, they're Arabs. Well, most of them aren't. You know, they come from places, Croatia. They come from, obviously, from Pakistan and Afghanistan and many other areas where they're not Arabs at all. So you have multiple cultural and linguistic groups. Also, in many instances, the countries that their families came from, the police were very adversarial, were very totalitarian. And so it's not a career looked upon as being a favorable pursuit. Now, that changes over time, and we end up getting a good number of people from every walk of life, every type of religion, every type of race or background. But the growth of the Muslim population in the United States, if you discount the Black Muslim movement, but those that whose origins are from overseas, it has been fairly small, and many of them were either not attending universities, or if they were, they were in going into areas of science and research, and weren't really interested in law enforcement. So the effort has to be there to go out and reach out and convince people that there is a very interesting and challenging and meaningful career available in the law enforcement arena.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Next on the line is Patrick in Richardson. Hey, Patrick.
Hey. My question is to your guest. I'm not sure if he was in active duty or on September 11th, but the case involved Ali Muhammad, who was an FBI informant with an FBI agent named Jack Clunan. And I guess it came out after September 11th that not only was he responsible in part for casing the 1997 Dar es Salaam bombings and the Nairobi bombings, but he also had pre-operational level intelligence of the methods they were going to use to hijack the planes on September 11th. And the FBI agents found this out post-September 11th. And they had the information with this informant. Now, whether he was that good of a triple-cross agent or whatever, you can combine that with Peggy Noonan from Minnesota, the field officer that came up with Zacharias Moussaoui. My problem is that, and the person who called in earlier that said, you know, I feel much safer with what's happened to Samadi, the September 11th Commission report said that the greatest thing we didn't have was a lack of imagination. And my fear is that the FBI is not set up to think asymmetrically. Just the culture, from the background with the 4 years in school to the way that they make their agents dress to the beautifulness of them, there's just not a culture in the FBI that is set up to think about these problems in a creative, and they're terrifying ideas. I'm not saying that there's any type of glory in thinking like that at all, but it's just not set up to think asymmetrically like the way Al-Qaeda does, and I'd love to get your thoughts on that. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for a call. What do you respond to that, Buck?
Well, while I was in charge of operations in the Bureau, we prevented 56 acts of terrorism, some that would have been on the magnitude of 9/11, and another that would have been the equivalent of Pan Am 103. We did try and think in front of the terrorists, but we were restricted substantially by law and regulation. Until 9/11, an FBI agent could not open a case on public information that could be collected off the streets by anyone. You had to have, in accordance with the Privacy Act and the Attorney General guidelines, a predicate to determine that that individual was involved in either criminal activity or terrorist activity by a recognized terrorist group. That makes it virtually impossible to act before there is an overt act on the part of the individuals. Now, after 9/11, the redefining of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, the rewriting of the Attorney General guidelines, that has changed. You've seen a number of instances recently where the Bureau has successfully interceded in planned attacks on Fort Dix and various other places. Minneapolis situation is totally misunderstood. The 9/11 Commission got it totally wrong. The law at the time was that in order to get a FISA order for either a search or an intercept, you had to not only determine that the individual was likely a terrorist, but you had to connect them with a known government or international terrorist organization that had been identified. In the case there, that had not happened, and that was what was being worked on at the time. And so, you know, it was obviously extremely frustrating to the agents in Minneapolis, but it was just as frustrating to the agents working with the Justice Department on trying to get through the requirements that had been set in law for them to be able to get a warrant from the FISA court. That has changed, and that is occurring. And certainly the caller is correct. It appeared to be a lack of imagination. It was not. It was a lack of the authority and the ability to follow up on, for instance, the memorandum of the agent from Phoenix about an inordinate number of people from the Middle East taking flight training. Well, that was very good observation, but it had absolutely no weight in opening cases, because to do so would have violated, without a predicate, would have violated the very thing that was being emphasized, was that in the United States, we didn't go on the basis of a racial profile. That, in fact, it was U.S. policy to invite foreign students to come to the United States for flight training for safety purposes and economic purposes. And then also that Saudi Arabia, where 15 of the hijackers came from, was considered an ally from which a terrorist attack had never been mounted against the United States. So it's a complicated issue. I can understand the frustration, and I can tell you I was not in the FBI at the time of 9/11. I was frustrated, and all of my associates in the Bureau were certainly frustrated as well.
The caller also made the point about the perspective, at least from the outside, that if not ethnically and geographically, there seems to be a sort of homogeneity among agents who work for the FBI. They have the same amount of education. They've gone through similar kinds of training, and maybe that puts everybody sort of at the same mindset.
Well, one, that's not true. It is probably is a perception, but there are all races and ethnic groups in the Bureau. There are degrees from every university, from MIT down to East Podunk State. You know, they have to pass the same tests. They have to have the same qualifications. And by the way, you can't come in the FBI with a four-year college degree. You have to have either a law degree, accounting degree, or 3 years of professional level experience, or an advanced degree in science or technology. If you could walk into an FBI office today and try and point out, you know, where this person came from, whether they're an agent, an analyst, a support person, a technician, you wouldn't be able to do it. As far as the dress, the Ephraim Zimbalist form of dress is very seldom seen unless they're interviewing bankers or testifying in court. So FBI agents and surveillance personnel are dressed according to the circumstances in which they are involved.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We'll speak next with Sean in Dallas. Hello, Sean.
Hi. I have a quick question.
Okay.
I'd like to I'll ask my question, then I'll hang up and allow the gentleman to answer. I first wanted to thank him for what he does for our country, and that I appreciate that. He had made the comment about recruiting, and I was curious to how the federal agencies address the fact that when they recruit someone of the Islam faith, that there's the possibility that that individual may have to go against his own Islamic brothers and either incarcerate that person or possibly even have to kill that person. I was just wondering how they address that in a training level when it categorically, the Quran categorically prohibits that, and how do they get around that? I would be curious as to how they would do that. Thank you for your time.
Thanks for your call.
Well, first, factually, more Muslims are killed by Muslims than by anyone else, by a large element. The prohibition in the Quran has not stopped Muslim countries making war against other Muslim countries or for sects within a particular country for targeting other Muslims. So although that is an ideal, it certainly is not a practical application. We have many religions represented in the FBI. where the thou shalt not kill is a commandment. But there are, of course, exceptions to protect the lives of others, for protection of yourself, and so forth. When you know that, unlike in the military, where you are taught to be aggressive and to kill the enemy or disable the enemy, in the Bureau you're taught to use the minimum force necessary to accomplish the mission. And so it makes it somewhat easier for the FBI than it is for the military. But in the military, they have to determine that the individual is willing to use force of arms in carrying out their mission, and that the mission is a legitimate mission and one in which they can justifiably participate. And that's, of course, of concern. But there are other religions that have the same difficulty, and that's the reason there's the conscientious objector status that is available to personnel. Of course, that was primarily used during the draft, because today all of the people in the armed services are there as volunteers.
How attractive is North Texas as a terrorist target?
Well, Osama bin Laden's lieutenant was residing here in Arlington as managing a tire store. The driver of the truck into the basement of the World Trade Center bombing in 1993 came from Dallas, flew to New York, and drove the truck into the basement. We, of course, had the Holy Land Foundation here. We had the IAP, the Islamic Association for Palestine, here. One of the targets that Timothy McVeigh scoped out was our courthouse, our federal courthouse. So Dallas has a worldwide reputation, and it certainly is a viable target.
Buck Revell is my guest. He's president of Revell Group International and former associate deputy director of the FBI. He will address the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth tonight at 6:30 on the Law Enforcement View of Terrorism. We'll resume our conversation in a moment and invite you to join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can make your passion your career. Evening classes are now available in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking this hour about the law enforcement view of terrorism with Buck Revell, president of Revell Group International and former associate deputy director of the FBI. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. People working globally against terrorism have talked a lot about the potential value of soft power in diffusing the urge to commit violent acts against the United States. I recognize that this is sort of outside the domain of the FBI, but I wonder if you see a role for soft power in preventing terrorism here on U.S. soil.
Of course. I think outreach to minority communities, and I mean sincere outreach. I don't mean just having a meeting and sitting around and chewing the fat, but real discussions, debates, the attempt to convey what your real mission is and why that mission protects you as well. I think those are all important elements in so-called soft power. In dealing with terrorism, government has essentially five capabilities. You have the diplomatic, you have economic, you have covert operations, you have military operations, and you have law enforcement operations. In the United States, we cannot use military operations or covert operations, and we do not have diplomatic capabilities. Economics is an area outside the bailiwick of law enforcement. So in dealing with the potential of terrorism in the United States, it really gets down to dealing with cities and their governments and the churches and community organizations to reach out and to have the ongoing dialogue, and then to law enforcement to detect as early as possible through legitimate legal intelligence means, and then act to preempt acts of terrorism, but only after you've determined the extent and depth of the group or organization, if possible. And, of course, that becomes to a screeching halt when they reach a capability and intent to carry out a specific act of terrorism. Never in the history of the U.S. government that I'm aware of, and certainly not in the 30 years that I served the FBI or the 15 years that I have been advising the FBI, has a terrorist act been allowed to occur.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to John in Forney. Hello, John.
Hey, how you guys doing?
Great, thank you.
Love the show, by the way.
Thanks.
I was just basically calling. I guess you had stated earlier, that they don't accept bachelor degrees, like you can't get into the FBI with just a bachelor's degree. And I was wondering why that is. Like, I know that there are some other government and agencies actually accept you in, especially like with considerations for superior academic achievement or whatever it may be, and I was just wondering why. And then a second question, or actually a comment, is I think that one caller who called earlier about talking about how there's like this homogenous view of the FBI, I think he might have been talking about like how there is like this good boy like image of the FBI where like you can't have any blots on your record to actually get in there. It just seems, and I think that's what he was talking like the homogenous mentality about it. But as far as the bachelor question, I would love to hear the answer, and I'd take your comments off the air and keep it up, Chris. Bye.
Thanks for your call.
The reason for that goes back to the early beginnings of the Bureau when they wanted a mature workforce, and they believed that a 21-year-old college graduate didn't have the maturity to carry out the full range and functions of the FBI. The law degree or the CPA gave them a couple of years beyond the baccalaureate degree. Nowadays, of course, master's degrees in engineering and science and languages are very highly sought. 3 years experience as a military officer or a police investigator are also highly sought. So it really is a matter of believing that the level of maturity, and obviously some 19-year-olds are a lot more mature than some 40-year-olds. It goes by the individual. But looking at it from a standpoint of a numerical age, 23 was considered probably the youngest that an agent would be appointed, and the degree of experience beyond a bachelor's degree was what they were looking for. Not to try and exclude anyone, but you can come in the FBI right out of high school in a support capacity. You can also come in as a linguist or as a technical person or an intelligence analyst. But for the special agent position, requirements have been set, and they have stayed pretty much the same, although they have emphasized language and technology more recently, particularly since 9/11.
Aside from the education and experience criteria, Buck, what makes a person likely to be a good FBI agent? What qualities do the best agents share?
Well, dedication to duty, certainly an inquisitive mind, an open mind, the ability to absorb detail and to be analytical in the thought process, to be focused on the objective of solving the crime or the situation, and a commitment to do whatever is legally allowed and necessary to complete the mission.
Technology has come up several times this hour, and I'm curious about how the FBI stays ahead of all the changing means of electronic communication and of wireless communication.
Well, it's very difficult. We do, in fact, have a cyber crimes laboratory associated with the FBI office here in Dallas, and it's a very busy place. The most difficult thing in the Bureau has been to get their own technology up to date because of the 3-year congressional budget cycle. And
there's still bureaucracy there.
There's bureaucracy, and by the time you get something you've budgeted for, it's no longer state of the art. And it's been very difficult to get up to the state of the art. And frankly, I say this with regret, there is no federal agency that is at the state of the art in technology, even NSA. Now, they are way ahead of the state of the art in certain areas. But when it comes to communications operability and ability to share information and so forth, even the NSA has difficulties. So it's a continuing issue and problem and a very expensive process, but it's an absolutely essential and necessary one.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Greg in Dallas. Hello, Greg.
Hi. I was calling to ask about the mobility clause in FBI employment and recruitment. I mean, I guess my impression is you want to apply for the FBI, you have to be willing to move whenever they want you to move. And I'm wondering how you feel about that in terms of I would imagine that they're losing access to a lot of good employable people who aren't willing to, say, leave the state.
Thanks for your call.
Well, that's true. Mobility is always an issue, but it's one that you is addressed before you join. I had 9 moves in my career of 30 years. I can't say that that was enjoyable, but it was necessary. Most agents, if they don't go into supervisory or management ranks, will serve in 2, perhaps 3 offices. And it is a nationwide, in fact, a worldwide service. Being posted overseas is voluntary. Being posted in any U.S. state or territory is not. It's where the needs of the service require. And that is very heavily emphasized, and it's part of the sign-up process when you come in the Bureau. And it may be that, let's say that you come in and you speak a foreign language for which there is no real need in Dallas, but there may be a need in Cleveland. So you would generally go to a small office for about 2 years for your continuing on-the-job training and then be transferred to where that need for that particular language capability exists. And if you don't have the ability to move your personnel around, and this applies only to 3 categories, to special agents, to analysts, and to surveillance support personnel. Others can come in and have their entire career, in Dallas or in any other field division. But as a national and international service, the director and the senior management of the Bureau has to have the flexibility to move people where they're needed. Unfortunately, during my watch, I had a time when I was in charge of administration for the Bureau, and that issue came up, and we were heavily stacked with experienced agents in small and medium-sized offices, and we were very sparsely populated by experienced agents in places like New York, Chicago, Washington, D.C., and so forth. And we had to move a lot of people that did not want to move. Some ended up leaving the Bureau, and I always regretted that. But it was the obligation of the director and my obligation at that time to see that each office was staffed with people that had the ability, experience, and skill to carry out the mission.
Recognizing that everyone who works for any organization, public or private, government or otherwise, will say that more money and more resources would help, are there specific areas where you would like to see the FBI really bolster the resources available to its personnel?
I would like to, let me say that I talked with Director Mueller, Bob Mueller, last month, and he's been very pleased with the support that he's received both from the Bush administration and from the Obama administration. And the Bureau has grown significantly since 9/11, including establishment of legal attaché offices overseas. And, of course, the Joint Terrorism Task Forces and the field intelligence groups, what they call FIGs. I don't know if I'd want to be known as being a FIG, but field intelligence groups have been established. But the budget has expanded substantially. What Director Mueller's concerned about, and virtually every agent in charge that I talk to, is the abandonment of enforcement of other very vital areas of the Bureau's jurisdiction. And
at the expense of terrorism, at the expense of other things.
Of other things, including very substantial white-collar crimes, violent crime task forces. The Bureau is virtually out of the drug enforcement business, where it focused on organized crime, its nexus to drugs. The counterintelligence arena has suffered somewhat, but that has been pretty much reestablished because of the challenges there. But I would like to see the President, the Office of Management and Budget, and the Congress bring back the level of enforcement that was ongoing at the time of 9/11, when so many agents had to be pulled over and put into terrorism, because the FBI is the principal investigative agency of the federal government, and it should be able to carry out its duties, functions, and jurisdictions across the board.
Are we safer today than we were before 9/11?
We're safer, but we'll never be safe. You cannot stop murders. You can't stop bank robberies, kidnappings, or carjackings. A lone wolf can walk into a place and kill somebody because of a hate motive that's based on a terrorist propaganda. But we are safer. Our borders are still not nearly as secure as they should be. We have a lot more to do on transit security. But as far as sharing information, the authorities and capabilities of the agencies, they're working together. We're much better off than we were. But we must understand that you can never be safe from any act of terrorism. The Israelis know that. The British know that. If you lived in a society where terrorism couldn't occur, it would be a totally totalitarian society that you wouldn't want to live in.
Buck Revell has been my guest this hour. He is president of the Revell Group International and former associate deputy director of the FBI. He will speak tonight at 6:30 to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. You can find out more about that event at dfwworld.org or on the Think page at kera.org. Buck, it's been a pleasure to have you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
The Think team includes assistant producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.